Great. Well, let me ask you this. It's 12:15. Mm-hmm. You need to stop at 12:30.
It's actually 12 o'clock.
It's 12 o'clock?
Yeah,
oh, okay, good. Okay, good.
So, yeah, we got 30 minutes.
Okay. Well, we'll check in again in a little bit then and see what choice you want to make. All right. So, do you want to say more about your work with SWCC, like what, like how you transitioned out and into Southerners for Economic Justice?
Well, like I said, you know, what was happening was I got the fellowship, and they moved the office to Georgia, and I didn't want to particularly live in Georgia, but I also was starting to get a real clear sense of this organizing thing. Because, see, I don't recall hearing anybody talk about organizing, per se, prior to going to Kentucky. And I didn't fully understand it. I didn't know I didn't fully understand it. All I knew was that organizing from the vantage point of, well, there was some level of organizing within the context of the Battered Women's Movement. Actually, there was a lot of organizing, but not in the most traditional sense that I know now. There was some level of organizing because you were building organizations to deal with battered women's issues. But in terms of like community-based stuff, it most of my consciousness in those years was raised by my time with SWCC. And so I started thinking about how desperately we needed organizing in North Carolina, and in particular in Eden and in the area that I had grown up. And so I wanted to relocate to North Carolina to start doing community organizing and build my own organization. Now, understand that at that point, it was a good idea, it was a great vision, but I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I really didn't. I didn't know what I would be doing. I didn't know how to go about doing it. I just knew it was a lot of people doing it and making some powerful change in that community, and I wanted to be a part of making that happen at home. Well, the mistake I made when I came home to do this was that I forgot I had to pay for my car to be able to get around and do anything. I also was totally naive about what it would take to do the level of fundraising and development of a board. I mean, really what it takes to build an organization, stuff I teach now that I didn't have a clue about then. And so I had not been home probably a week when I got a call from Christina Davis McCoy. And Christina made me aware that SEJ was looking for an interim director because the executive director had gotten a fellowship with the Charles Bannerman Foundation. And because she had already received it, they needed somebody pretty soon. And so she told me to go over and interview for it. Now, at that point, I'd only been an interim director of SWCC for 6 months. And to this day, I'm still not clear how I was able to do what I did there, because it wasn't like I had been trained to run organizations. Well, I didn't have no more training to run them when I did SWCC than I did when I came to SEJ. But I had enough sense to know how to be able to monitor, the financial management of the organization, some limited staff supervision experience. And so it was like, I'm willing to come over here and try this, you know, and it's only 6 months, you know. I ended up staying at SEJ for 10 years, but that's how I ended up coming to SEJ and leaving SWCC. It was a number of things, from the office moving to my desire to come back to North Carolina and start organizing.
So tell me what about some of that, the mission and the work of SEJ. What was it like? What were some things you learned?
Southerners for Economic Justice. Man, I tell you, every step along the path of my development has been critical and important. But SEJ, my goodness, it was awesome, because it honed and sharpened my understanding about workers' issues. See, some of what I've already said, I can articulate the way I do because of the SEJ experience. Not because of the experiences I was describing, because the things that were happening prior to SEJ, I could tell you things about it, but my analysis, my understanding was honed in SEJ. Because, see, SEJ was an organization that started out historically, and I mean, it had been around for quite a while by the time I came along. I want to say 10 or 15 years, because I stayed there 10, and I think the SEJ may have celebrated like a 25th anniversary before I left. Might have been 20th or 25th, I can't remember which, but I know that SEJ started out trying to help support worker organizing in J.P. Stevens' plant, and their whole goal was to build support within the faith community and within the broader neighboring community of J.P. Stevens and subsequently other plants to support the right for workers to organize and for workers to organize. We did documentation. We tried to do organizing, a working women's project, where we were trying to bring working women together. And it's interesting. The Working Women's Organizing Project was a very important project in the sense that it brought workers across workplaces together to begin to talk about the kinds of working conditions they were facing. But one of the important lessons that came out of trying to build that project was understanding that it is a challenge to try to bring workers together to organize for any number of things if they're coming from different workplaces, because the commonality, the synergy around a common threat that they're facing in a workplace is difficult to try to crystallize. You got different infrastructures that you're trying to deal with. So it was a real challenge trying to build a strong working women's organization, because you didn't have a campaign that you could really kind of bring together. Different levels of discrimination. Like if you had women who had been sexually harassed or discriminated against, if you talk about impact in federal law, it's still not going to do anything about what was happening in particular workplaces. And you didn't have all of the workers from the same workplace that could mount a particular strategy against that particular employer. These were a few workers from several different workplaces. So that was just a real important kind of perspective that we gained trying to build that. It ultimately, instead of having an organizing campaign, ultimately instead of having some victories, it was a support group basically for working women, which wasn't a bad thing, but in terms of trying to create institutional change, it wasn't able to accomplish that. We worked on things like the Workers' Bill of Rights. We documented what was happening to contingent workers by doing interviews with people who were in part-time and temporary work, and recognizing that this whole trend toward contingent workforce, whether part-time, temporary, or contractual, while there's a percentage of people who really appreciate being able to be contingent because it allows them flexibility, there are a lot more people who were saying that they absolutely resented the fact that their only choice was part-time, temporary, you know, contingent work, because that was the nature of what was happening in the workforce, where jobs, full-time jobs with good benefits, were being downgraded to part-time and temporary work without benefits. And this was across the board from, you know, people who were menial laborers to people who were low-income workers, to people who were high-income in the, technology industries, the IT industries over there in Research Triangle Park. You had people saying, I came to work today at a job where you have prepared yourself educationally, you have done all of the right things to get in the door of an IBM or some other major corporation, and then you come in one day and they tell you that you're laid off. They tell you that, you know, as a Friday, they give you a pink slip, you're no longer employed. And this is observing that people can work hard and do what is so-called, quote-unquote, the right thing, to make the right choices. And the nature of corporate interest is to operate to maximize profit. And you maximize profit when you can, you know, create a working situation where people don't have to get benefits, people don't have to work beyond a certain number of hours. Their work hours can be minimized so that you don't have to pay them certain kinds of, you know, time and a half and overtime and that kind of stuff. You don't have to give them certain kind of benefits. So, you know, just through our work at SEJ, learning about, you know, how corporate interests operate and how workers health and safety is compromised because of that. Looking at work, we did some work with poultry workers and, you know, tried to provide support. We actually, as an organization, helped to facilitate the creation of the Hamlet Response Coalition after the Hamlet fire. We worked in conjunction with the social workers and the, you know, AF, LCIO, and so a whole lot of players who came in Kosh. A lot of players came to the table, and when they came to the table, you know, we were committed to ensuring that the workers were at the table. We really wanted to see that happen. And over time, what I observed was the people who are connected are the ones who ended up at the ninth hour in the state legislature with the policymakers shaping the final deal around strengthening of health and safety laws. I wasn't the one who was there at those meetings as intensively toward the end as I was at the beginning. So I don't know where the compromises happened. But one of the most important lessons I think I learned at SEJ, besides the things that I've mentioned, has to do with when you're doing serious social change organizing work, how you really have to look at the people who are most impacted as the target for those who are organized. Because anytime you start to go for people who are at the middle or upper income levels to address a particular issue, when people are not, when their life, livelihood, their health and safety, their survival is not connected to whatever is being negotiated, then people compromise. And they compromise in a way that people whose livelihood and their survival is the way that they want. You know, we did work with welfare reform as a part of my work with SEJ, organizing welfare recipients to speak on their own behalf at the state legislature and at the congressional hearings on welfare reform to speak from their own experience about what that transition ought to look like. What might a new welfare policy look like rather than eliminating people's access to help, you know? If indeed the welfare system was going to be decreased, what kinds of things do they need to be armed to move from welfare to work? And it was interesting because we went into the state legislature and found a legislator who was willing to sponsor legislation that was supposed to be an overall package for how the state was going to respond and deal with welfare reform the state.
Who was that, and what was the, do you remember a bill number?
I don't remember, oh no, I wouldn't remember that. Now, that might be able to dig that up, okay. But I don't remember, I mean, because you had House Resolution,
yeah.
I want to say 1274. Now, where that comes from, it very well could end up being that that's what it is. Somewhere it's in the back of your head and you can pull it up. But anyway, there was Senate version and there was a House version, and there were all kinds of elements to it. But the particular thing I want to speak to now, and I won't call names, but there is a particular lobbyist who their job is to be over there lobbying around issues that are important to us as poor and working class, poor and working class people. There was an effort to get the state legislator who was working with us to include a provision in the legislation that allowed women who were on welfare to use their education toward their work requirement. Because part of what was being pushed was that if you are on welfare and you're able to work physically, mentally, you got to go to work, period. No question, no ifs, ands, and buts. And so the effort was to say, instead of women being required to just jump off of welfare and go into a job, if they are in school, let them stay there. If they want to pursue education so that they position themselves potentially to get higher income jobs, let them do that. So instead of the work requirement, let their school, their education endeavors meet that work requirement. So that was what we were trying to do. So when you take welfare recipients into the state legislature to talk to legislators about this issue, you take them in with the understanding that they're not compromising, because whether or not they can get prepared to make higher wages is a matter of survival for them. Especially if you're getting ready to say that they can't get welfare anymore for a lifetime after a certain period. But for a lobbyist who's going in, who is comfortable, who is not on welfare, who is not going to be impacted whether or not this is adopted or not. For them to go in and talk to a legislator about including that provision, if you go in and you all are having a conversation and this person says, this ain't winnable, we cannot win this, this is not an issue that I'm willing to put on the table, or, you know, somehow or another they express some unwillingness or some hesitation, your reaction as a lobbyist, since what you want is a winnable package, is to let it go. Whereas somebody who's impacted by whether or not it passes or not is not. And so that's what I'm saying about understanding who you target and who has the greatest stake in seeing certain things done when you're doing organizing. And that was my experience, where this person actually, when we weren't there, talked to this legislator and took that, and they agreed to take that provision out of the legislation.
Which legislator?
Yeah. Well, Alma Adams, because she, and I don't mind mentioning Alma, because Alma was a real ally and a friend to us in trying to do this. And so when we brought it, what happened was the day that the bill was marked up and was coming out of the, being written, you know, the whatever the committee is, or the staff area where they draft legislation, when we saw it, we saw that that piece was missing, and we went right to her. She understood why it should be there. She said she didn't know why it was left out, but we know that there was some consultation that was happening with the lobbyists, who we then saw later and said, look, this needs to be in there. We've already talked to our representative. She said that she would make sure it got back in there, and indeed she did. But it was really interesting how, because people who were most affected by that particular policy were not there to defend it themselves and to make sure that it didn't fall through the crack, it ended up falling through. So I probably should not say that they negotiated or agreed not to take it out, although that is some of what I've heard and surmised. The bottom line is they didn't have a vested interest, either of them, in that piece of that particular aspect of the legislation staying. And that's why I know that it's important that if you're going to be impacted by a certain policy, you need to be at the table. That was an important lesson I got out of SCJ. You know what I'm saying? And so over and over and over, it was emphasized for us the importance of working people being organized to advocate for their own interests. The other thing that I remember that was a significant part of our time spent educating folk in the community was the work we did to try to help people understand why there ought to be opposition to the North American Free Trade Agreement. And one of the convenings that happened that spoke to issues that we needed to understand about NAFTA was a convening at the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus getting lost. And so it was called a Quad National Gathering. And I forget what they called that period of time for that 500 years. Anyway, it was to mark the anniversary of him, you know, ushering in the domination of indigenous folks. And what we were able to do was to convene. And I don't think, I know I wasn't the executive director then. Leah was the executive director then. I was just there as a program staff person. And the convening included people from the Caribbean, Canada, United States, and Mexico, workers from those four areas. And so that's when we began to understand how these jobs were moving from Canada as a result of the U.S.-Canada trade agreement, that a lot of the workers, see, if you heard the business people or you heard the politicians talk about the U.S. Canada trade agreement, they would laud that as a very successful accomplishment. But if you talk to workers, you heard the perspective that that trade agreement caused them to lose a lot of jobs and lowered wage standards for them, because so much of our conversation was about people losing their jobs, about people talking about plant closings. The same thing that the South experienced with NAFTA. But see, what they were doing was they were projecting what would potentially happen, what would definitely happen if the U.S. had a trade agreement with Mexico. And so you would listen to these workers talking about this. You would hear Caribbeans talking about what was happening around banana production with, you know, Europe and how they had been, had their economy crippled when their largest importer of their bananas was saying they weren't going to buy them anymore because they wouldn't get them from somewhere else. So we started to understand some serious on-the-ground impacts, grassroots impact of trade policy. Something that you don't normally think about being something that community people can understand, but if you're talking to community people about the impact, they are foretelling what is going to happen to you. You know, it was a real grassroots effort to understand trade policy and its impact on local communities and to try to organize people to try to fight against that policy because of what it would do to our economy in the South and this country. So that's a whole lot of stuff about SEJ time. I don't even know until I start having these kinds of conversations how much I knew or learned about while I was at SEJ. So that's probably as much as I can say right now. You can ask me more about it, but right off the top of my head, those were the things that made the greatest impression, I think, in retrospect.
Why'd you leave in 2000?
Because I was getting ready to run for U.S. Senate. I was also really ready to transition into something else. But in 2001, I left like in December 2000. 2001 was when I started running for U.S. Senate. It was for the 2002 campaign, but really laying the foundation in 2001. And so I also knew that I had done what I... It's interesting you should ask that, because what I'm also thinking about is that at the end of 10 years... I had done as much as I thought I could do, and I felt like there were things that needed to happen in terms of board expansion and development, in terms of time for a new strategic plan. So when I left SEJ, I left SEJ with a year's budget in hand or committed, and a consultant who had already been hired to help with a strategic plan, and an administrative staff person who could be there to help set up meetings and do stuff with the board as they began to figure out if they were going to hire a new executive director or if they were going to, just be on the sidelines or whatever and do the planning before they looked at hiring new staff. So part of what I was realizing was that not only was I about to run for office, but I think that it's important for organizations not to have executive directors that are there for perpetuity. I think it's important for new leadership to be in place. I wish that we had had the resources and I had the insight to cultivate somebody to take my place, to develop somebody to take my place. The other thing is that there's questions that are often raised for me, not just from the SEJ experience, but from other organizations about whether or not When is enough enough? When is it time to throw in the towel and not keep struggling to try to make something work?
As an organization or a person?
I'm saying as an organization and as a person. I'm saying organizations need to be making that assessment. Have we outlived our usefulness? Are we just writing grants to collect money to keep people in jobs? Or have we important work that we still need to do in this organization? Or is it time for us to, you know, stop? Because a lot of what we set out to do is done, and we don't need to stay in place just because we established it 5, 10, 20 years ago. I do believe it's important for working people and poor people to have organizations that ultimately form institutions for them. But I don't think that you ought to keep being formally organized when you don't have the kind of critical mass and interest to keep the organization viable. And I also think that, you know, as leaders, we have to consciously ask if certain things are not happening or if things are happening, why it is, at what point does it make sense to move over for somebody else to be in that leadership position? Don't even mean that you have to, it doesn't even mean that you have to leave the organization completely. I mean, there are a number of roles you can play, but you don't have to be the executive director or the person who's, you know, heading up the organization. So.
Yeah. Well, since it's almost 12:30, let me tell you what I still want to talk about, and then let's make a decision about.
We can get together.
Good.
I think, yeah, I don't have no problem with that. Good. I can talk until. First of all, I know the way I talk drags out a story for 100 years before I get to the end of the point. So I know it could take a long time. What I'm not clear about is how much tape and paper do you plan to use up on one interview?
No, I think this is wonderful and really rich and just the kind of stuff that adds a lot to the historical record and a lot to activists and organizers coming up who want to learn and even informs us today. You're in the thick of it. So I think it's just rich and wonderful. So if you've still got the energy and the willingness to keep on going, meet again.
Okay.
All right, then I'm not even going to talk about it. We'll just plug along next time. All right, let's stop here then. Thanks, Cynthia. I already queued it up for the right, for this section. All right. Man, I had a headache. I had the first migraine of my life Saturday night. Jacob crawled up on the bed, said something in my ear, started crying. It hurt so bad. Pete was turning on the water faucet to fill up our vaporizer. Okay. So, it is March 7th, right? 2006, here we are, Cynthia Brown, Third Space Studios, Durham, for part 3 of our wonderful interview. So, you ready to roll?
I'm ready.
All right, good. So let's start with kind of jumping back a little bit. In the midst of your work with Southerners for Economic Justice in 1995, you were elected to the Durham City Council, right? And you served through 1999, right?
Right.
So how'd you decide to run, and what was that experience like?
Well, it's funny because in some ways I didn't totally decide, and some of it is truly encouragement from other people. Some of it is about a part of a spiritual journey that I've been on for many years. But initially, there was a woman I met in the community who was a longtime activist in Durham. I'd heard her name before. I'd happened to be in a few settings where I was working with various activists concerned about living wage issues among city workers, people who had been concerned about the need for economic development in Durham to create decent wage jobs for people. So in this work, in various forums, this African-American older woman who had been a longtime activist was somebody who had just observed me interacting with various people in the community. And so one day...
Who is that?
Her name was Van Ellison.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually said to me, you should consider running for city council. Well, I've only lived in Durham less than a year. I had moved here in April of 94. She was asking me this sometime in 94. And the election was in November of 95. And so when she asked me, I'm thinking, I've worked here since 1990, but I've only lived here less than a year. So it's bizarre for me to consider running for city council right now, because I think Durham is a town that is built on old relationships. It can tend to be cliquish, where it's difficult to move in this town unless you've been given sanction by the organized leadership in the various political organizations. And so I didn't think that there was anything realistic about me trying to run at that point. But, you know, I told her I would think about it. Well, just by saying I'll think about it, she started talking to various people she knew all over the city, black and white alike. And because she would say to them, what do you think about Cynthia running for city council? They would say they thought it was a great idea, and they started putting pressure on me. So everywhere I would go in the city, people would say, I heard you thinking about running for city council. If you do, I'll work on your campaign. If you do, I'll help you. And I mean, over and over, this scene played itself out. So part of it was, you know, the encouragement I got from various people I ran into in the community. But then the other piece of it was that I really have been guided by spirit most of my life, in a way that I am not aware of oftentimes, you know, except in retrospect, but in a very conscious way at that point in my life. So I just, you know, prayed and asked God if it was time and if it was something I should do, because I always had wanted to be in politics. And then at various times when I started to really understand what politics were about, in terms of relationships and one-upmanship, and, you know, you vote for me and I'll vote for you on various issues. And, you know, so I got disenchanted with politics and said I would not do politics. Then I started realizing how important it was for people of conscience to be in politics, so we had allies from those of us in the community to get somebody to give us access to the process. So I started realizing the importance of, you know, politically conscious people with progressive thinking being in politics. So between feeling that I prayed and that I got direct instructions from God, you know, truly feeling affirmed by the voice of God that this is time for me to do this. But it was, you know, a process that combined my spiritual affirmation and, you know, encouragement from the community. And to be honest with you, when I ran for U.S. Senate several years later, the reason that I started my own business was because when I ran for city council, I worked every day almost that I was running for city council. So I worked full-time and I campaigned full-time, and it almost killed me. I mean, it was absolutely exhausting.
Would you do it again?
Yeah, I probably would do it again, but I would do it differently. I mean, now that I'm self-employed, it makes it a lot easier not to have to be accountable to a board of directors, a staff, and a constituency as a part of an organization while you're also doing the campaigning. But there were a lot of things that I learned from that city council run. I mean, politics is dirty. And I can remember when I ran for city council and when I ran for U.S. Senate, I mean, the kind of jokes that people who love you and who are friends with you do as it relates to the dishonesty of politicians, the dishonesty of lawyers. You know, it's like two of the most reviled groups of people on the planet are attorneys and politicians. And even though I understand the cynicism and the sarcasm, it's also a challenge when you know that what you're trying to do is bring integrity into a process that is so maligned and so, you know, hated, reviled by people, because, you know, politicians are a terrible lot of people for the most part. And the people who are good, even, I've learned, if they don't have a base of people that they're organized and connected to, that it makes it very difficult not to get just sucked up by the process of, you know, the politics.
So some accountability with community.
Some accountability with community. But the strange thing is that the system is so distorted at this point that even when you have a base, if we don't get some changes in how the system operates, the fundamental way that the system operates, the people who are good people end up being able to win because they're getting money from people, and that money ends up creating a level of accountability to the people who have donated the money to their campaigns. And so, you know, it's interesting. When I ran for, you need to
switch. Yeah, let me switch. Hang on. We're going to change tapes here. Okay, go ahead.
Put me back on track.
So you're talking about the money issue in politics, and when you were running, you...
Well, you know what? What I was getting ready to tell was a story about how one of the people running during the same time I was running used to always laugh and tell me how he wanted to know how I was raising my money, because he said, "You raising more money than anybody in this city other than the mayor, mayoral candidate." And I didn't believe him, because as fast as the money came in, it went out, because it's very expensive. At that time, it wasn't nearly as expensive as it is now. I mean, I think I raised a little over $10,000 for a city council race. The mayoral candidate raised $13,000. And I only raised it by sending out letters to everybody that I knew, whoever knew me. I didn't get any kind of PAC money or anything like that. And it just so happened that that's what those little bitty checks amounted to. But I had a national network because of having been involved in national organizations. So, and I'd been in the Kellogg Fellowship, and of course I sent letters to all my Kellogg fellows. And so I ended up raising all this money, and I remember one of the highlights of my campaign, which was, you know, actually very strange. I could not even imagine being in a candidates forum, having to go up against and, you know, compete with seasoned veteran politicians. But when you're passionate about something and you think it's the right thing, you feel like God on one side has said that this is something that you're supposed to do, and the community people have said on the other side is something you should do, then you just stand up even when your knees are buckling, you know, and you really are nervous about it. And I remember being in a Chamber of Commerce candidates forum that was televised, and the question being asked by council member Kim Griffin, he was a long time, he was a retired dentist, he'd been on the city council for eons, I mean many, many years, and I was so nervous because what they did was each of the candidates got to choose a number, and the number they chose determined who would be asking you a question of the candidates in the whole pool of city council candidates. And so this veteran council member asked the question, which I thought he was going to go into stuff related to how the city is run. And he asked the question why I had money from somewhere, all from people all over the country. They acted as if I was some interloper who was being supported by some radical activists outside of the community who had just kind of like inserted me into Durham to take over Durham politics. And nothing could have been further from the truth, of course. And so what it did was open up the opportunity for me to talk about my fundraising strategy, which was that just raise money from everybody I knew, and to really run down the kinds of groups I had been associated with, which made a certain impression, obviously, on the voters, but also dispelled a lot of that myth around, you know, this mythology that had been created about where in the world I came from. And it was so weird because people always associated some major agenda around anything that I did, even when I was on council. And usually it came from a place of being connected to people in community and knowing that the perspective that they were bringing was going to be radically different than some major developer's agenda or some political scheme or some politician's, you know, agenda. It really was about trying to be a voice for everyday community people. And so clearly I would do it again, but I think that I would do it quite differently, because one of the biggest regrets I had was when I was on city council, it never occurred to me that if you work full-time and you have all those meetings to go to on the city council, you take seriously being out in the community, going to the different functions that people invite you to, that that's all your time. There is no real time to do organizing to make sure that there's a base to which you're accountable. And because the public, even though they want accountability, they are not organizing themselves in a way, in mass, to hold people accountable. They're angry because people are not being accountable, but they're not taking time, extra time, to ensure that they're engaged in civic organizations to press for that accountability. It ends up being a class thing where the upper income, middle income people end up being the ones who are organized to press for accountability around issues specific to their neighborhood, specific to their interests, not to the overall community. So you don't have, for example, people who are impacted by low-wage jobs being the ones who are organizing to say, you can't use my tax dollars to bring a plan in here that's going to employ people other than me. You know, you don't have people whose communities are being impacted by environmental contamination organizing for the most part, unless they're upper income people. You know, you got upper income people, and so the most vulnerable people in the community are the ones that are the least organized, and those are the people that I oftentimes wanted to be accountable to. And only was I successful in one instance in particular that I can think of where there were some concerns about the housing code and people who were paying rent to slum landlords, and they weren't being provided with heat and adequate insulation. And so there were some revisions made to the housing code as a result of my connecting with some folks. But even then, there wasn't a mass organizing campaign. It was a couple of folks in the neighborhood who brought an issue that had a broader impact for everybody. So figuring out how you connect with folk in a real way during the campaign, so that work of people working together is not just about getting me elected, but, you know, providing support and information and accountability to me and for the duration of my time in the office.
Yeah, there's so many challenges around that, not just for elected officials, but even for like nonprofit organizations that say they're accountable to community members, but mm-hmm. what community means and mm-hmm. how to do that in a way that crosses barriers of class and race. Mm-hmm. And in a real practical way is a real challenge.
That's right.
So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that there's a lot of organized, kind of traditional organized leadership in various organizations and political parties in Durham. Mm-hmm. That you know you had to get on the in crowd and you mm-hmm. know get on their radar. And so, who are some of those people and groups that you understand to be real?
Well, let me say that when I ran for city council, and I haven't been plugged into local politics in a real way in a while, so I know that some of these groups may not be in existence, but most of them I think are. You had the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, which is the Black Political Action Committee, PAC. And then you had the People's Alliance, which is the White Progressive Political Action Committee, or they have a Political Action Committee as a part of their agenda. Then you had the Friends of Durham, which was the White Conservative Organization. And then there was another one, and that's the one that I don't think is in existence anymore, the Durham... I don't remember the name of this, the fourth one, but it was more of a moderate, predominantly white, if not all white group, but they were more moderate. And I actually got the endorsement of all of these political action committees with the exception of one. But you also have the Independent Weekly, which did endorsements, and I got their endorsement. You had the News and Observer, which did endorsements, and I'm sure I got their endorsement. So I actually ended up with the endorsement of all the major organizations except for the Friends of Durham, which was the conservative organization, and they said about me, if you think that you like Larissa Sabo, who was a white progressive, S-E-I-B-E-L, L-O-R-I-S-A, Larissa Sabo, if you like Larissa Sabo, who they obviously had critiqued over the years because they couldn't stand how progressive she was. She worked for Durham Affordable Housing and was always, you know, trying to advocate for issues that impact low-income folks. And so because a lot of what she advocated went up against the interests of these conservatives, they actually, you know, probably criticized her a lot. So their commentary about me was, if you think you like Larissa Sabo, you'll love Cynthia, which means that I was even worse in their mind than Larissa. But it was interesting because during that time, the race dynamics of this city really played themselves out because when I was running for city council, I remember that the African-American community really didn't know what to make of me because I had so much white support. And so the assumption was that I was this kind of person who could be manipulated and controlled by the white community, which nothing could be further from the truth, but how would you really know that if you didn't know me? And because I didn't spend a lot of time going to regular meetings of the Durham Committee, I didn't know about the organization. And when I learned about it, a lot of their meetings on the night that they convened were in conflict with my community work. And so I never was very engaged in the main organization for African Americans in this community. And it wasn't because I disrespected the leadership or that I didn't want to do it. It just really came into conflict. And then there were a whole lot of other issues with folks who really wanted to be somewhat controlling. And I'm not one who does real well with being controlled. I like what Shirley Chisholm used to say, that she was unbought and unbossed. And I like the idea of being unbought and unbossed. I remember when I ran for U.S. Senate, this guy came up to me from Raleigh. He worked for state government. And he told me, he said, I've been dying to meet you. And I said, why? And he said, because I wanted to know who this person is that everybody's making such a big deal over. He said, you know that they don't like you over there in Raleigh. And he was talking about folks who were candidates in the U.S. Senate race. And several other candidates came out of Raleigh. And I said, why? He said, because they know that you don't owe anybody and nobody owes you. And so that nobody can tell you what to do. And I just remember thinking how liberating it is to be engaged in politics as dirty as it is, on your own terms, so that you don't have to be controlled by people.
So from August 2001, so apparently it didn't totally chew you up, because like you said, there were some liberating aspects of it, and also from August 2001 through September 2002, you were a U.S. Senate candidate in the Democratic primary, North Carolina's 2002 U.S. Senate race, right?
Now,
is that true? No, it isn't.
Not only is it true, but, you know, now it's always a challenge to talk about this and why I did this, because it's hard for people to grasp, folks who genuinely have a relationship with God. I don't think that God talks to me, like in an audible voice, like you and I are talking. But I truly believe that I talk to God, and that God whispers into my spirit things that I'm supposed to do. And I know that without a doubt, that if it had not been for God leading me to run for U.S. Senate, I never would have done it. Because frankly, there was nothing logical about running for U.S. Senate when I ran. I had not been engaged in party politics, so I was not one of the insiders in the Democratic Party process. And that within itself is enough to keep you from winning any particular office, unless you got a lot of money behind you somewhere else to help you overcome the barriers created by not being a party insider. I didn't know a lot about the process itself in terms of the way that they have these party conventions and stuff. But the way that this campaign came together and the kind of progress that we made with everybody connected to my campaign, just about being absolute novices in the electoral political process, it just says to me that it is absolutely important that I actually ran in that race. I actually ran in a state with 100 counties where I campaigned in at least 67 of them. I actually raised less than $50,000. I guess we raised about $48,000 to $49,000. I had no paid staff. I had one coordinator who got a little stipend. God bless him. He lost his job shortly after he started working with me, and he lived off of unemployment and my stipend so that he could help coordinate my campaign.
And that was
Ken McDougal.
Yeah, Ken McDougal,
bless his heart. He didn't know nothing about politics, but he was a smart man, and he could figure it out, and he figured it out what he could, you know. And what he couldn't figure out, somebody else. There was a wonderful man, Michael Schwalbe, S-C-H-W-A-L-B-E. Michael Schwalbe was my, I don't know, he was a one-man team to help me with my positions and to help educate me on issues and to provide me with research. And
He's a professor over at NC State,
absolutely. Girl, I mean, I had some incredible people to surround me. I mean, sisters, African-American women in the community who just made sure that I ate good, that I got places, that I was dressed decent. I mean, literally carried me somewhere while I'm dressing in the car, because I was having to make appearances in 3 or 4 different counties in 1 24-hour period. I actually had people who came together in the western part of the state who would get somebody, a volunteer, to drive me from the west, from the east. One guy came to my house here in Durham, picked me up, took me to northeastern North Carolina, and then drove me back to Charlotte. And then somebody connected with us once we left Charlotte and went to Black Mountain. And in Black Mountain, somebody else got me in the West and brought me back that night. Now, I'm telling you, all this happened in a 24-hour period. So, to me, there were so many things that were happening that made it clear that this was something that was supposed to be. First of all, my presence in that campaign meant that people were forced to talk about things that they otherwise would not have talked about, around, you know, working conditions and workers and immigrant kinds of issues. Just the spin that I would put, the perspective I would bring on a particular issue, forced them to have to deal with it, because once it was... And the funny thing is that, see, you figure somebody shows up in a race with a former chief of staff of a U.S. president, you know, Bowles. The current Erskine Bowles, the Secretary of State of your state of North Carolina, Elaine Marshall, a 22-year African-American veteran of the state legislature, the first Speaker of the House, anybody who would get Dan Blue, you have somebody who shows up in a race to compete with them, and they have no roots in the party, and they don't have any history beyond having been on the city council, and you figure they got to be stupid. Stupid of being paid off. And I mean, people actually said to me, who's paying you off? They thought the Republican Party actually had paid me to get into this race. And nothing was further from the truth, obviously, but you also don't expect for that person to come into the process with an analysis and to be able to articulate issues at the same level as these folks. But see, what I had it to my advantage was the fact that I had been engaged in public policy advocacy for 20 years. But my perspective on how to advocate for certain kinds of public policies was helping to teach people in the community affected by that policy how to engage in the process. And I had been involved with partners and allies from the local to the federal level, because we had worked on campaigns to raise the minimum wage, to create living wage policy here in the state. We'd worked on welfare reform from the state to the federal level. We worked on campaigns to try to get a workers' bill of rights in the local city council. So, I mean, my whole last professional life, my whole last 20 years prior to running for office, had been public policy advocacy. And it's funny because until I was running for office, I never talked about it in those terms. But when you consider that you're talking about shaping policy that's going to meet the needs of people in the community, that's exactly what I was doing. And so I understood the process. And what I would say to people is, and I didn't walk in with the advantage of some of my competitors, because they were inside the process, so they had something to negotiate with. We had to scrap from the bottom to be heard, much less to understand where decisions were being made and who we had to talk to be able to have an impact. And so, I don't even remember. What was the question? You know, I get on a roll. This U.S. Senate thing, this thing was wild. I mean, for me, I cannot tell you. First of all, I want to go back and say that we actually came out of that process with almost 30,000 votes. I mean, I want to say that it depends on whose numbers you look at. I never looked at final counts, but at one point somebody said I had made close to 29,000. Somebody else said 26. So I figure it's 26 to 29. Anything over 25 says I came close to 30,000 votes. The person who won, who had millions of dollars invested, won with 200 and some thousand votes. That ain't nothing to sneeze at. It is absolutely nothing to sneeze at, nothing to be ashamed of, to have run in that race and to gotten that kind of visibility. My girlfriend said, a friend of mine up in Baltimore who I used to room with who in North Carolina, she said, you couldn't have sent out invitations and you couldn't have bought that many votes. So she said, that's not bad.
What's her name?
Delmia. Uh-huh. A girlfriend of mine named Delmia Strickland. Mm-hmm. She was so funny because she called the next day just to see how I did. And I think it's funny because most people assume that I wouldn't win. I never assumed I wouldn't win. What I knew was that I was a long shot. But I know that because I believe in a God of miracles, that there are stranger things have happened. So I thought it would be wild if I woke up and I actually had won as such a long shot. But the other thing was, I was crying. I was so happy when I saw that morning that I had made over 19,000 votes. Because all I kept thinking was, I don't want to have worked this hard and not have made some kind of impact, not have had some people to listen. But see, one of the things that happened when I was on the city council trail, on the U.S. Senate trail, I ran into people who I'd met on the street who were homeless, who came to a nice, fabulous, see, this was the beauty of being out west. They had this old building that the senior citizens tower was, that had this top floor that had garden, garden terraces all around the rooftop room. And they had this incredible, beautiful, looked like a high dollar, classy affair. And it had beautiful live music, had people who were dressed nice, had people who were dressed not so nice. It was a mixture of residents in that building, people off the street, people who had known me since I'd been campaigning out there, people who had never heard of me but wanted to hear more about this person. So it was literally the melting pot of this state and of this country in that room. But homeless people who would come up to me and say, I have never heard a politician who sounded like you. And I'm telling you, I have not registered to vote in 20 years, and I'm going to register tomorrow. Because I intend to vote and work for your campaign. And I'm telling you that you could go to the western part of the state, and every other block had one of my street signs on it. And let me tell you, my signs were made in the basement of somebody's apartment. And they sent those signs all over the state. They just happened to be more plentiful in the west because that's where we had a stronger base. And the irony of that is that I'm an African-American candidate, and that's predominantly white part of the state. You know that because that's where you're from. And I'm telling you, it was fascinating. There were people who were in parts of, like there's a place called Taylorsville. And Martha, I can't think of Martha's last name right now. Now, Martha lives in Taylorsville, but Martha was, and I am so happy to be able to tell this story and have it somewhere documented, because this was one of the more beautiful experiences of this campaign. Martha was in North Wilkesboro when I spoke at a Democratic Party meeting one evening, and they had invited all the candidates at different points, and this was my turn. And Martha was at the back of the room, but I was really connecting with people around the lack of health care, what was happening around economic development and our desperate need for jobs, and not to betray decent workers in communities who had given their lives to the different employers and now were losing their jobs because of NAFTA and job loss and whatnot. And so she ended up connecting with me outside of the meeting room. I got a pretty decent reception. There were some folks who were very pro-business who didn't like this idea of raising the minimum wage and challenged me on that. Some folks who had issues around the Social Security issue. But the thing was is that this woman came outside and she told me she used to be a Republican and she had switched to the Democratic Party because she had become very disheartened by how inhumane and how racist she felt that the Republicans had become.
She a white woman?
This is a white woman. There was nobody in this room of color but me, which was a lot of the case, and mind-boggling because it's like you're here now. And so it doesn't matter. You got to still tell the story, even if they end up, you know, knocking you out of this room. Well, what happened was because I was being so real and so genuine and talking about issues from not some political rhetoric place, but from a place that people could really relate to based on their own experience, it ended up going over very well, and I really ended up connecting with people in a real meaningful way. So what ended up happening was the lady came outside. She ended up talking to me about really hoping. Now, it's interesting. Because I was just so genuine, she really was saying she wanted a way to get the people in her community to come together across race lines. She said it's predominantly white, but there are African Americans. There's a woman there who's a good friend of mine. I really would like to see you be able to help inspire us to come together. So ultimately, out of that experience that night, she ended up praying with me outside to give me what she considered, you know, protective cover as I came back down the mountain, because I was leaving at 11 o'clock almost at night, maybe 10 o'clock at night, but it was late. No, it actually was right close to 9 o'clock at night, and she knew it would be close to midnight by the time I got back home. So her thing was to give me protection over. So I'm amazed because I'm very spiritual at this time, and I am connecting with this woman around our shared faith in a God that can protect you even as you're out here on your own in these mountains. And so she ended up literally convening the Democratic Party in her county to come to a luncheon to meet me. People bought potluck stuff, set up this beautiful luncheon, this old white Democratic Party building. It was an old house, one of those looked like something from Terror or something, you know, one of those old South houses, you know, with all their columns and stuff. Anyway, I get there, and this place is packed. Every Democrat that you could imagine within a 50-mile radius of this town must be at this luncheon. And I'm blown away because I didn't expect anything this big a deal. Black and white alike, they had this woman who gave this resounding, beautiful gospel song, and then they introduced me to speak. And something happened. I don't know what it was, but I was overcome with emotion. I was overcome with the passion around the issues that I know are important to me and why I was there. And I spoke from that place. And I'm telling you that I got a standing ovation in that room like you would not believe. And when I got it, there was a sheriff candidate in there who was the current sheriff who was running for office. They tell me that for a few weeks afterwards, when there was a Democratic Party event and I couldn't be there because I didn't know about it, plus I had a conflict, that the sheriff's candidate stood up and spoke on my behalf. They tell me that in lots of places, that's what would happen when people had heard me. They would stand up and speak on my behalf to make sure that people knew who I was. It was unbelievable. I remember one time I was in Black Mountain, and I spoke. The woman who was the president of that particular Democratic Party, you know, precinct or whatever, it was a major event. They had invited all the candidates. This happened to be my turn. It was a dinner meeting. She chastised me because I wasn't standing at the door. Because, see, I would engage with people in a real way. So even though I should have been standing at the door just kind of shaking everybody's hand, I would get preoccupied getting in a real conversation with a person. So her thing was like, really, like, it was a courtesy in her mind for me to be allowed to come there. It was just a courtesy. And so they didn't expect much from me, obviously. And they kind of, some of them gave me the feeling that even though they were nice, that they really hated that they had to give me this time. But I was there. They had to do it. So I sit down and I have dinner, and then she gets ready to introduce. She introduces me, this president. When she introduces me, as I walked up there, she said, no paper. I mean, looked at me real snidely and suggested as if to say, no paper, like unprepared. And I proceeded to speak. And at this point, I've been doing this for a while, and I've gotten to say I was polished would suggest that I was packaging it. What had happened was I'd become very clear and succinct about the key points I wanted to make. Limited time meant focus on the issues, make your points, and sit down. So I was bam, bam, bam. Between health care, lack of jobs, the living in a country that's as prosperous as ours, understanding that there are people who have to be put back in this process so that they have what they need. Understanding that you need an elected official who does not come in with an agenda that is their own but is committed to a process with people. Talking to them about how my life has been about bringing people into the process. I mean, boom, 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 I'm done. I stopped saying the last word and the room was having thunderous applause. Nobody in this room is not on their feet. The woman who had made it possible for me to get there that day whispered to the person next to her and said, is this unusual? And the person said to her, this has never happened before. This has never happened before. That I was on a high that day. But part of it was understanding that when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, that there is nothing anybody can do to stop you from being good and successful at it. If you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, and I'm not just talking about what you're supposed to be doing because you got the educational preparation, but because it is also like a spiritual destiny. And I just am real clear that there are African Americans and whites who came together in ways they never had in various counties because of their support for me, so that opened up some doors. I know that there are people in relationships that wouldn't have been. I've got at least three couples I know, you included, who I know ended up getting married because they met or deepened a relationship with somebody who they knew coming to one of the affairs that I had. I have been clear that much of the work that I've been able to do in grassroots communities, providing support and training to folks as a part of my business, my ability to do my business and have been doing my own business for 4 years is in part something that got spurred from the travel I did across the state, the relationships I began to establish when I was on the campaign trail. Just a lot of things as it relates to grassroots, you know, visibility of issues and, you know, building a base, continuing to build this base through the work that I do. All of that is a part of the overall plan that got initiated by me running for U.S. Senate. And I could go on and on, but I know you've got other questions, and we don't want to have to come back 50 million times. But I just have to say that that was a powerful experience. One last thing I want to say is I can't tell you how many times I found myself fully clothed, not in the bathroom because I had to use it, but sitting on a commode just pondering, why in the world am I here? Scared to death, having a clue why I don't slip out the back door, except that I got young people who believe in me, who are volunteering for my campaign, who are outside with proud and ready for their candidate, regardless of the fact that we're a ragtag team, and I don't want to let them down. I mean, sometimes that's all that kept me at some of those events, because they were things that were major in a way that I never expected. The first time I went to a Young Dem statewide event, where it would be the first time that the Democratic candidates were going to be on a major stage, talking to issues. And I don't know what I expected, because I'd only had two experiences with Young Dems. And one was with college students over at UNC. One was with Young Dems, who were young professionals, mostly white, one African-American over in Wake County. So I didn't know what to expect of this event, but I really learned that Young Dems is a training ground for the children of the existing and current elected officials to learn the political process so that they can take inherit the mantle that their parents pass on. I mean, it really is a training ground for new politicians. And you may not have parents who are in politics, but certainly all of their children are there, and then you have some children who may learn about it and understand that that's a potential place to do it. And it ended up being every Democrat in this state, from the state to the federal level, from the local to the federal level, who were at this particular event to hear these candidates. And I'm thinking, what in the world? And that was early on, before I'd gotten real crisp and clear about making points, because as you can see, I'm very long-winded. And if you got to be 30-second responses, one-minute responses, it takes a little practice to get to a place where you can be as concise as some of those seasoned veterans. The other thing is that it was interesting, because I would always feel so intimidated by the candidates because they sounded so good. And sometimes I would be gone from an event where we had been talking to the public, and I would be gone for an hour or two before I realized, for real, they didn't say anything. There was very little substance to some of the responses, but because it sounded good and because it had some key buzzwords, I thought it was saying something, but it took a little analysis and thought later, and so it made you think about kind of the dazzle that has people bewitched and keeps them from focusing on real issues. Because, I mean, it's hard, if people dazzle you, to think about how you analyze what they're saying and really challenge them. So, anyway.
So tell me a little bit more about the Sojourner Group that you founded in 2001, right? Why the name and what's its mission? And
well, the interesting thing is that I actually started that business simply because I knew I could not work for somebody and campaign at the same time. Remember I said that when I was in city council, when I was in that campaign, I worked for Southerners for Economic Justice. And because I have a fundamental belief that when you work for folks that you ought to be accountable to them and that you ought to produce, I knew I could not travel around to 100 counties in this state and campaign at the level that I needed to without more flexibility and without a job. But that meant I needed to start my own consulting business. And for a long time, I didn't have a name for it. I just was a consultant out here freelancing. And I remember Tema Okun was the first person I called because I knew she had done consulting for a lot of years, and I just wanted to know, what do I charge people for doing what I do? And she said then $600 to $800 a day, and I remember thinking, I can't believe people get paid that much money in a day for doing work. It blew me away. But I thought, boy, if somebody will give me that for what I do, then that would really help me pay my bills while I do this campaign, and that's basically what I did. And basically, I didn't even know what I knew. I just knew that if I had been working in nonprofits for 20 years, that I had something to share. And I had something to share not only because of having done it all that time, but having had hired a lot of consultants to do training. And I had things to offer that I had learned from what was the best of the training, as well as some of the worst. I knew what I could do to improve the training.
So fundamentally, I would say there are five key areas that I do training in that's designed primarily to strengthen nonprofit community-based organizations. I help people either start their own organization or I help them strengthen the organization by focusing on board development, talking about board roles and responsibilities and a whole range of things that they need to do to be accountable to the nonprofit that they are governing. I do fiscal management, fundraising, grant writing, work around strategic planning and program planning, and like I said, fundraising and fiscal management. And so those are key areas, but there's also tons of stuff that people ask me to do that end up being things that I draw from my experience, but they're not formal areas that I had initially planned to. I help to do a lot of stuff around meeting facilitation. You may have some stuff that needs to be done or something you want to accomplish. We talk about it. I help people set up the agenda, and then I facilitate the meeting because they need an outside objective person to help move them from one place to another. And so the whole goal is really building these folks in the community their capacity to address the issues that they want to address and still be accountable in these nonprofit organizations that they're operating. And one day I was coming back from one of the retreats that one of the groups I worked for had convened, and there were three of us in the car, Savvy Horn, S-A-V-I-H-O-R-N-E, Savvy Horn and Danielle O'Hara. And we were riding in the van, and I was saying, y'all, I have to have a name for my business. And Savvy said, well, you need something spiritual, something that's like you. And she said, something that is reflective of you, like the Sojourner Group or something like that. And literally, she said that, and I kept looking, and nothing ever stuck like that. I mean, I really like the Sojourner Group. And the Sojourner Group is about the sojourn from one place to another in your development, from a place where you don't really know all that you need to know to have the capacity you need and the experience that you go through with the group that I'm working with helps move you from that one place to the other. But it's also a play on Sojourner Truth, who was a, you know, slave, abolitionist and a women's right, you know, activist. And so, you know, I started reading up, you know the basics about Sojourner Truth, but to really read stuff about her, narratives about her, and to really know more about her, it reminds me of the kind of things that are important to me. And certainly women's rights and women's suffrage, you know, is really, really this idea of women and their status needing to be championed in a world that is so misogynist and so patriarchal. And so that I mean, my beginnings in the battered women's movement, you know, really sealed my fate in terms of being a women's rights activist. But also this idea of challenging slavery, you know, at a time when, you know, women were just like chattel as African, you know, descendants as well as, you know, women. And so this idea that she was represented those two things, and I certainly see those things being integral to my organizational development work, helping people look deeper at those kinds of issues. So that's the story behind Sojourner Group. And I'm real excited about Sojourner Group because I see a lot of potential for it. And I have, it's primarily me, but I also bring different friends on to co-train with me so that we have a loose association, but I tend to, you know, find the work and then we do it. And it's usually for, you know, people in my circle of friends who are tired of their job and want to get out and do this kind of stuff, or they just need to supplement their income, or they just have good skills and they'll be willing to help me out. So that whole group thing stuck because it didn't mean that it had to be a static group of people, but a dynamic group of folks who come in and out of the group.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad it's going well.
Yeah, me too.
So what keeps you motivated to do this kind of work, and what shuts you down?